second case for oral argument this morning is Randall and Lori Massad. Massad, okay, thank you. Appellants versus Doug Weber et al. Appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Michael Schaefer and Mr. Paul Lindy, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Schaefer, I understand you'll be arguing this morning. All right. And for the appellees, we have Mr. James Moore and Mr. James Power, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Moore, you'll be arguing this morning.
Yes, sir.
Very well. Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. It's my privilege to represent Randy and Lori Massad in this case. They're the plaintiffs and appellants. Their claims were dismissed by the circuit court under the statutes 3-21-8 and 3-21-9, subsection 5, in this case. We contend in the first place that the trial court erred in just conclusorily holding that those statutes applied without any analysis as to whether they factually applied. We also contend that to the extent that they do apply and bar the claims in this case, they violate the open courts provision, the equal protection and due process provisions of the South Dakota Constitution. We also contend that the trial court erred in holding that Randy was not a third-party beneficiary under the contract with CBM and the state.
If we rule, rule in your favor on your first issue, that as far as the statutes are concerned, do either of those other two issues need to be addressed, particularly the third one with the beneficiary of the contract?
Well, if you rule in our favor that the statutes don't apply under the facts, the court, under the principle that you can avoid a constitutional question by construing the statute, no, you don't have to answer that.
What about the beneficiary?
I think the court still has to deal with the third issue. I mean, they're alternative theories, so theoretically we could proceed to trial on the negligence claim and the claim for breach of contract under the third-party beneficiary claim. This case arises out of a brutal attack on Randy Massad, who was a kitchen supervisor and employee of Catering by Marlins on March 19, 2004. He was in the kitchen office when an inmate, Gregory Stevens, got out of his cell, got off of his unit, got into the kitchen, grabbed what was referred to as a whisk, which is basically like a metal bodor about 4 feet long, and hit him 10 to 15 times about the head, causing him severe brain damage, which is permanent. Stevens was admitted to the penitentiary in December of 2003, was a violent and explosive criminal, and while he was pending sentencing from Turner County, smashed and broke the orbital bones in an inmate in the Clay County Jail, and was actually indicted for aggravated assault and on hold issued by Judge Rush when he was sent to the penitentiary. He was sent on February 6th to Springfield after his admission and orientation, and he wasn't even there 2 days, and he got in fight with another inmate and beat him up with a pool cue and was written up and sentenced to 45 days of disciplinary segregation down there. He was shipped back to Sioux Falls and hadn't been there more than a week when he was convicted again of a disciplinary violation for threatening staff, this time saying words to the effect, "I'm going to get me one." And he was given a 30-day consecutive sentence as a result of that. Now, for some unknown reason, an undocumented reason, on March 9th, he was given a hearing, an administrative segregation hearing, and was moved into the general population. The prison at Sioux Falls did not have his institutional file, did not know. They knew he had gotten into trouble in Springfield, and purportedly, although it's not clear from the record, that they knew about the infraction up at the Hill, but it's not clear from the documentation that they had, but they didn't know the violent history of this inmate, and even Bob Ray, who was one of the employees that sat on this committee that assigned him to the general population, didn't even realize he was still on disciplinary sentence and would have been until April 23rd of 2004, long after this assault had occurred. And because they didn't have the rules at the penitentiary required an individual at Springfield to ship the file. I mean, this is not discretionary. It's a mandatory rule that says whenever an inmate goes from Springfield to Sioux Falls, and it was Sandy Wexler, we took her deposition, asked her why wasn't his file shipped, and she says, I don't know, I guess I just screwed up. So then he gets into the general population in the Jameson unit, and he's on the B unit. If he had been in the A unit, where he had been briefly in disciplinary and administrative segregation, he would not have even been allowed off the unit. But in the B unit, inmates can leave. There's three doors they got to get out of: their cell door, the section door, and the unit door. And those are all controlled by the control officer. In this case, it was Mr. Greenwood. So three doors had to be open for him to leave his cell, his section, and his unit to get where he got. And he was not permitted off of the unit for any reason that is established in the evidence. He wasn't assigned to work. He wasn't assigned to school. And the only other possible reason that an inmate can get off of the unit is if they are given a pass for some reason. There's no documentation of a pass having been issued, and in fact, all the documentation was destroyed, even though after Randy's assault, he got out and did the same thing again 2 days later on the 21st of March and was caught this time, and they went back and looked at the videotape and figured out it was him that had gotten into the kitchen by using an orange jumpsuit that he grabbed off of a laundry cart to get in and was buzzed in by a control officer who would let any inmate in that had orange or white on at the time. So we deposed the individuals that were responsible for controlling the inmates and the movement of the inmates. And the testimony was pretty unequivocal that the policies and procedures in place required them to keep those inmates in their cell or on the unit unless they were authorized to be off, which they've conceded he wasn't. So the question was asked, is this a question of inadequate or insufficient equipment, facilities, personnel, programs, and the like? No. It was a function of simply not doing their job. That's what it boils down to, and they admitted it. The control officer in Mr. Greenwood and the floor officers in that unit. So the question then is, when this case was presented, the trial court, without any analysis, simply said that these statutes, 321.8 and 321.9 sub 5, apply and bar the claim. I've read the opinion many times. There's no analysis. They're thrown up there. And in fact, in this case, the state, or the defendants in this case, never even presented any evidence contrary to what we had presented, and never presented any statement of undisputed material fact arguing or pointing out how these statutes somehow applied to this case.
Well, it may be dicta of it, but we have said that the statutes apply to the operation and maintenance of jails.
I understand that the court has said that in, I believe, the Unruh decision, that there's general language to that effect, and I went back and it looks like it came out of the Eighth Circuit case in Webb. It was cited in the Hancock case, and it was pulled out of that opinion. But this language has to mean something that says no person, political subdivision, or the state is liable for failure to provide a prison, jail, or penal or correctional facility, or if such facility is provided, for failure to provide sufficient equipment, personnel, programs, facilities, or services in a prison or other correction. It must mean something other than... If that last phrase doesn't mean anything, they could have put a period there at the end, and it would be the end of the discussion, at least under that statute.
Mr. Schaefer, doesn't the last word in that phrase of services, how broad that word is, isn't that critical? The state is arguing that services, the most important service provided by a penitentiary is security. That's their argument.
And what they've said, in essence, is they've said services means security, sufficient means competent or adequate, therefore, and I took this right out of page 13 of their brief, failure to provide sufficient services includes the Massett's claim that the employees failed to adequately perform their duties. I mean, it stretches to the point, it's kind of like Alice in Wonderland. Words mean what I say they mean, and therefore that becomes a rule of construction that therefore bars any claim. If the legislature intended to bar any claim, they could have said that. They wouldn't have had to put anything in here. They could have put a period after providing the facility itself. But these words and what they had in mind at the time, who knows? Were they thinking of services in the nature of medical services, in the nature of rehabilitation, drug treatment, alcohol? I don't know. But when you got UNRU, you got it on a certified question from the Federal District Court, and with a limited scope of review and a limited question that says, is this immunity waived by the purchase of insurance? And UNRU did involve the failure to provide medical services, which arguably, even though you didn't have to address the question, could come in to the scope of that term.
Well, but UNRU was broader than that. The plaintiffs in there claimed the man was simply abandoned in his cell.
Well, I think that he had heart problems, he had no medication, no medical treatment, didn't bring his medicine with him, and he ended up dying as a result of it. But there's certainly an inference, and I know you didn't have to apply the law to the facts, because apparently the only question was whether there was a waiver. Services there clearly could have included medical services. But I think that that's too broad, and I think that here they had the burden of proof. They asserted both of these statutes as affirmative defenses. They had the burden to prove that these statutes in the first place applied. Now, we don't think the second one applies because we think, as this court recognized in Hall versus City of Watertown, that applies when you're dealing with parole or release situations. It's not that all-encompassing because you have to look at the predicate for the statute. But if the court concludes, and I realize you can avoid the constitutional issue that wasn't addressed in UNRU if you determine that these statutes do not apply to bar the claim. If you determine that they do apply, then you are faced with the question that was left open in UNRU. And that question is whether or not these statutes violate the open courts provision and additionally the equal protection and due process provisions.
Didn't we answer that question in Wig-Leitner where we said that all the open courts provision does is guarantee you access if you bring a valid cause of action to the court? It does not create a cause of action.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. I think in Wig-Leitner, my recollection of the reading of that was the court held essentially that there was no dram shop claim at common law. And when the court in Kylo looked at what claims existed at common law, the court held and concluded that a state employee performing a ministerial function was liable for his negligence at common law. That preceded statehood, it preceded the adoption of the Constitution. And that was followed by this court, and because the court concluded that that cause of action existed at common law, it held that the legislature does not have the authority to wholly abrogate it. Now, there's all sorts of cases and statutes, and the court cited those, and Justice Gilbertson, you cited those in the UNRU opinion, that have variations of different kinds of immunity. We have the Vilhauer case, the rodeo case, where it wasn't completely barred, and that's why the court said it was saved, because it wasn't a complete ban. It allowed a claim to be brought with a heightened burden of proof for willful, wanton, or reckless conduct and some other factors for faulty equipment. The same is true under our emergency statute, which says that someone responding to an emergency in good faith is immune, but they're not immune for willful, wanton, or reckless misconduct. So if a statute completely bars the claim, as it did in Kylo, it's subject to being overturned under the open courts provision. And even among the statutes that the court cited was the one involving immunity for municipalities in the operation of parks and recreational facilities. Well, we know that the court held that was unconstitutional in Oyen because it was in violation of the open courts provision. Now, the circuit court here said, we don't think Kylo applies because this statute doesn't distinguish between discretionary and ministerial. I submit that's a distinction without a difference. Because if you think about it, if after Kylo was decided, the legislature passed a statute that said every state employee is immune from suit for any damages or injuries caused by the operation of a motor vehicle. Let's assume that statute's passed. Well, I think it's clear that the court would say, you can't do that. We just held it's unconstitutional. It violates the open courts provision because it immunizes a ministerial function. And just because you don't use the word ministerial or discretionary in the statute doesn't mean that the court can't look at it and say if it bars everything, then it's subject to the same attack as the statute was in Kylo. The second thing that the court...
Schaefer, going back to that distinction and the Wigleiter case, that's based on common law, but this is dealing with statutory immunity. So isn't there...
I don't think there's that's the other ground that the trial court said Kylo doesn't apply because this involves statutory versus sovereign immunity. I looked at Kylo. I reread Kylo. Kylo involves statutory immunity. Under our Constitution, under Article 3, Section 27, the legislature shall direct the law in what manner and in what court suits may be brought against the state. Kylo involved a statute that said all state employees, whether they're performing ministerial or discretionary functions, are absolutely immune from suit. And then there was a separate provision that says to the extent that they participate in a risk pool, they've waived. But the court said the reason it came up in Kylo was because the state had narrowed that so tightly that it said it barred all hedonistic claims, claims for pain and suffering, loss of consortium. It only allowed a claim for medical bills and property damage. And the court says you can't do that. That's a violation of the open courts provision because driving is a ministerial function and you can't shield it. So I don't think, I was thinking about that. How could sovereign immunity, which derives from the common law and the Constitution, be less effective at barring a claim than statutory immunity? How could something the legislature passed have more power than something that derived from the Constitution and common law? It makes no sense. To call it statutory immunity, is a distinction without a difference because under our Constitution, the legislature, by statute, is the one that passes the laws as to how people can be sued.
The legislature's always had the authority to modify the common law by statute.
Well, I don't think, since a court said at common law, if a claim existed at common law prior to that predated the Constitution, and it held that ministerial functions performed negligently by state employees existed at common law, the legislature can't abrogate that claim. It's that simple. That's what Kylo says. It says you can't abrogate it, period. So they can't pass a law to say, which they did in Kylo, by the way. There was a statute that barred it. The other thing that I see my time is running out, but that I would like to point out is in Unruh, the question presented to the court was the question of whether this particular statute, and it was or for the purchase of insurance, waived the statutory immunity. The court looked at 21-32A1, which is the statute that applies to public entities other than the state, and that statute specifically had language in it that they shall be deemed to have waived the common law doctrine of sovereign immunity. The statute that applies to the state, that statute doesn't apply to the state. The statute that applies to the state is 21-32A-2, and it doesn't contain any language about common law sovereign immunity. It doesn't have that distinction. This claim is against the state and the state employees. So I think even under the Unruh case, there's a waiver here by purchase of or participation in the risk-sharing pool, which, by the way, has no exclusion for prisons, prison activities, or anything like that.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Moore, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court. In addition to Jim Power, I'm pleased to have with me this morning two of our summer associates who have the privilege of attending oral argument this morning. Tina Sikorsky from Hofstra University and Blaine Gray from the University of South Dakota are here. Mr. Schaefer spent about the first 10 minutes talking about the facts of the case. I just want to make clear that for purposes of the argument this morning, we concede the facts of this case. For purposes of argument, we concede that there was negligent conduct. For purposes of the argument, we concede that the conduct was ministerial. Despite those concessions, the question is whether the defendants are entitled to the statutory immunities provided by SDCL sections 321.8 and 9. The trial court said yes, and I think that the court can decide that strictly legal question about the application of the statutes and the constitutionality of the statutes as applied to ministerial conduct based on existing precedent of this court, starting with the question whether the statutes apply. Mr. Schaefer's argument is really dependent on one word in 321.8, and that is the word sufficient. And I would note that that word is not in 321.9. 321.9 simply says that there's no liability for injury caused by or resulting from services or programs administered by or on behalf of a prison. Sufficient doesn't come into play. The argument that Mr. Schaefer makes from the word sufficient is that it means quantity, not quality, and we're talking about not insufficient numbers of staff or insufficient equipment or insufficient resources. We're talking about people who simply fail to do their jobs. This court addressed that issue in Unruh in characterizing the statutes as applying to the operation and maintenance of jails or prisons. This court addressed that issue on the facts of two previous cases, both Unruh and the Hancock decision, which involved claims that insufficient medical care was provided for someone in custody, in one case in a jail and another case in a juvenile detention center. But the characterization of the claims in those cases is exactly the same, or could be exactly the same, as Mr. Schaefer characterizes his client's claims here, that the defendants failed to do their jobs. And despite that same characterization and same facts, this court had no difficulty concluding that on the plain language of those statutes that they applied to the conduct that was alleged. I think
if the legislature really wanted to immunize negligent conduct as is alleged here, I mean, why didn't they just pass a statute that just said that the operation and maintenance of jails is immune from liability? Why have this qualifying language about sufficiency and services and programs? That has to mean something. Is there an example of something that is not immunized?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to, first of all, 321.8 and the use of the word sufficient, I think that by common dictionary definition, sufficient means legally satisfactory. It means adequate. It means of such quality. It encompasses exactly the kinds of allegations that Mr. Schaefer has made with respect to the defendants in this case. And I don't think that it strains the ordinary or plain meaning of the word sufficient to give it those definitions and say that it applies in this case. So I don't think it's a strange construction on the part of the legislature.
But what about programs and services? I mean, that seems to be unnecessary language if the legislature just intended carte blanche immunization of the very basic core function of a jail or prison to provide secure environment for prisoners.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that between 321.8 and 321.9, subsection 5, what's apparent is that the legislature made an effort to extend the broadest immunity that it could to the activities that occur with respect to jails and prisons that might result in civil liability. And it's clear that they wanted to immunize it, and that's what the court said in Unruh when it construed the statutes as applying to the operation and maintenance of jails and prisons.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying programs and services would extend immunity outside the prison walls as long as it's a program and services of the Department of Corrections?
Yes.
So is there any?
But in this case, Your Honor, the question is whether security provided inside the institution is a service provided by the prison. And I think that,
that is the question, really, in interpreting this statute that we have to determine, isn't it?
And I think it's self-evident, Your Honor.
Well, why didn't they put security in here then?
Because
security doesn't normally, you wouldn't necessarily think of that as a service, because when you talk about, you know, parole services, probation services, programs provided to prisoners, it seems to me that fits in more with those kinds of services as opposed to security, basic things that you're looking at in a prison. Security would be, it doesn't seem to fall in services here the way it's been addressed.
I think, Your Honor, again, looking at the broad language of the statute, that services provided by a prison is very broad, and it's not limited to, the legislature didn't say educational
can't
services.
Can we broadly interpret an immunity statute?
Yes. I mean, within the plain language of the statute, Your Honor, I'm not aware of case law that says that an immunity statute has to be narrowly construed. But even if you narrowly construed this, I think the plain meaning of the term service of a service offered by a prison is security. If you go take the deposition of any state employee who works at the South Dakota State Penitentiary, and if you go depose the warden, the first thing they'll tell you about the responsibility of their job is to provide security. Security for the public and security for the inmates who are at the institution and security for the staff who work at the institution. Security is job one. It would strain credence to think that the legislature, in immunizing services provided by a prison or jail, did not include security.
We have security here today. That's provided protection of everybody involved in this proceeding. Doesn't it strike you as illogical that if the state is providing security outside the walls of a penitentiary, it has no obligation whatsoever to protect staff inside the walls?
Your Honor, I don't think the analogy is perfect. Security that's provided here is not provided in connection with the operation of a jail or a prison.
Right. So why is it every place in South Dakota security is a good thing, but apparently the legislature is indifferent enough to the operation of a penitentiary that if you're foolish enough to work there, you take your life in your hands?
I think that the legislature recognizes, Your Honor, when in enacting these statutes, the difficulties that are inherent in administering a prison or a jail. And I think the legislature recognized the litigiousness of prisoners. And I think the legislature...
But we're not dealing with a prisoner.
No, we're not, Your Honor. But the fact is that it would be, I think, anomalous to disregard that in trying to ascertain why the legislature enacted the immunity that it did. The United States Congress enacted the Prison Litigation Reform Act in the late 1980s because of the litigiousness of prisoners and the problems created by frivolous prison litigation, and that's based on constitutional standards in federal court, much higher burdens for anyone to meet than a common law negligence claim that can be pleaded in state court. And I think the legislature was aware that prisons are dangerous places and they're full of litigious people, and there's a certain degree of expertise that goes along with...
I understand that. Then why enter into a contract that deals with security with an outside vendor?
Well, because...
Which brings us to the third issue here. Why isn't he a third-party beneficiary from that contract that dealt with security?
I think the Sisney versus State case is dispositive of that issue because we have a government contract. In fact, we have the same contract that was
actually an employee of the person who's entering or the entity that's entering into the contract, which isn't exactly Sisney's case.
No, it's not exactly. It's the same.
He was a prisoner.
But correct. But it's a state contract. It's a government contract. And what the court said in Sisney is that for government contracts, basically we carve out an exception to the third-party beneficiary rule because we don't want members of the public to be able to rely on a government contract. And so you have to show from the face of the instrument itself an express intent to benefit the third-party beneficiary. And that doesn't occur in this case. And I think what makes that most evident is the difficulty that would occur if every employee of CBM were able to enforce the terms of that document. Once a third-party beneficiary relies on a contract made for that party's benefit, it can't be modified without the third-party beneficiary's consent. So now the state is negotiating not with someone on behalf of Catering by Marlins, but with every employee of Catering by Marlins. And that's an entirely different circumstance, and I think it's part of the reason for the third-party beneficiary rule that the court adopted in Sisney versus State. I want to address the constitutional issue.
Before you do, I have one remaining question on the statute. You know, I think it was Mr. Schaefer's brief talked about tort-free zones.
Yes.
And if in fact this statute is as broad and comprehensive as you suggest, is there any liability for any cause of action that remains, in your view, under the statute?
You mean for any negligence claim due to injuries sustained by someone as a result
in
of
connection
the,
with,
in connection with the operation or maintenance?
I mean, if you go close, if you get around near a penitentiary in one or have come into contact with an employee of a penitentiary or jail, as I understand your interpretation of the statute, there is no tort liability for negligence.
In state court, Your Honor, that's true.
So you're taking the position that it's an absolute, you probably don't like his words, but it is a tort-free zone inside there or in connection with an employee as far as negligence is concerned.
It's a broad immunity, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's not as broad as the immunity in Kylo, and I'll discuss that, but it's a broad immunity. It's not a tort-free zone in the sense that I've spent the better part of 12 years of my practice defending civil rights cases brought by inmates under the United States Constitution, most of which have been pleaded in federal court. It's not as if there are things that happen in prison that all of a sudden leaves everyone who's there without any remedy at all. And this court recognized that in the Hancock decision, in fact, that there were constitutional remedies that could be pursued and so did not leave the plaintiff without a remedy. With respect to the constitutional issue, Mr. Schaefer suggests that Kylo is really an absolute decision, and Kylo's not an absolute decision. I think what Kylo said is that the extension of sovereign immunity to ministerial acts goes too far because it immunizes all the ministerial conduct of state employees in whatever circumstance might exist. And Kylo talks about reasonable restrictions. Kylo says the legislature does not have the authority to wholly abrogate such common law actions guaranteed by the Constitution. It therefore can impose only reasonable restrictions that do not infringe on these protected rights. I think that's what the legislature has done in enacting the various statutory immunities that it has, including 321, 8, and 9. Look at Judge Teedy's decision in the appendix at page 8, because he has a catalog of the various and many statutory immunities that the legislature has enacted that apply to all kinds of circumstances, not just 321.8 and 9.
Well, how does 321.8, the definition of services, and in the context of this case, the actions of the guard in allowing the prisoner to move from one unit to the other, which is, you've conceded for this purpose, negligent, how is that different from Kyle, where we're talking about, again, negligence of, and the legislature determining that we're going to immunize this, which is a common law ministerial act?
Well, what happened in Kyle is the legislature tried to immunize driving a car. What is at issue in this case is a decision that I don't agree is ministerial, but will concede it is for purposes of appeal. In assigning an inmate to a particular housing unit and giving
him
the classification.
That's a different issue. That's classification.
Part of what Mr. Schaefer is talking about.
I agree. That's one of three different negligent actions. But one of I asked specifically about the allowing the inmate off the unit where he should have been.
Well, I think that's a causation issue, Your Honor, because what the corrections officer testified, there's a guy in the control pod.
Yeah, but we don't even get to causation because you're saying it's immune, and that's the issue with whether or not the legislature can immunize that ministerial act.
Well, for purposes of the argument, I accept that it's ministerial, Your Honor, and I think the legislature can immunize it. And I think this court has held that similar conduct survives an open court's challenge. And I would look specifically to the Purdy case, Purdy versus Fleming, and the Brown Eyes decision, both of which involve SDCL 2688-14, which is the immunity for good faith reporting of child abuse. And the court said in both of the Brown Eyes is especially illustrative because in Brown Eyes, the court went through the sovereign immunity analysis, decided that the conduct at issue was ministerial, and therefore sovereign immunity did not apply, but said here we have this immunity provided by statute, and even though the conduct is ministerial, the employees are immune. In the Purdy decision, the court specifically referenced an open court's challenge, and it's the same statutory immunity. Purdy contends that to the extent SDCL 2688-14 seeks to immunize the ministerial acts of public employees, it is unconstitutional. And this court, in two paragraphs, went through and said, in line with our previous holdings, we find SDCL 2688-14 constitutional, and therefore Cummings and Fleming's actions are shielded under this statute's immunity. The same question, Justice Severson, ministerial conduct. That whether you analogize it to driving a car in Kylo or not, is the subject of immunity granted by the legislature in this court based on its previous understandings of the open courts provision, especially as stated in Wegleitner, as pointed out by the Chief Justice, has said that's a reasonable restriction and does not violate the open courts provision. The language in Wegleitner is extremely broad. The legislature has the power to define the circumstances under which a remedy is legally cognizable and those under which it is not. So the open courts provision is not a means by which the court can strike down validly enacted immunities, which to some extent do abrogate a cause of action, just like a statute of limitation or a statute of repose abrogates a cause of action. For the plaintiff whose claim is barred, the relief is abrogated. And the same is true with the child abuse immunity discussed in Purdy and in Brown Eyes. That's not some heightened burden of proof. That is the abrogation of a claim based on negligence in failing to report if it was based on good faith. So I think that the constitutional issue that is presented before the court has been decided by the court. I think it's been decided in Purdy. I think it's been decided in the Brown Eyes case. I think it's been decided in the Enru case. Implicit in Mr. Schaefer's argument is that there is a distinction for purposes of SDCL 321-8 and 9 between discretionary and ministerial conduct. This court, as recently as the Unruh case and the Clay versus Weber case, said that's not true. That distinction applies to arguments based on sovereign immunity, but not to particular statutory immunities, and in particular 321-8 and 9. So I think the consequences of accepting Mr. Schaefer's argument on the constitutional issues are quite broad. One, because they would extend to the catalog of immunities that the legislature has enacted beyond SDCL 3-21-8 and 9. And secondly, because I think the court would have to confront its previous and recent decisions in Vilhauer and in Unruh and in Purdy and in Brown Eyes and in Cleveland, just a whole host of cases that I think are a significant obstacle to the argument that Mr. Schaefer has made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Kylo has never been overruled by any decision of this court. I cited the Cleveland case to say suggest that it was, and I reread the Cleveland case. It doesn't even cite Kylo. Kylo was a unanimous decision of this court in 1995, and in that case, this court said the legislature does not have the authority to wholly abrogate such common law actions guaranteed by the Constitution. They've now conceded for purposes of argument that this is a common law action, that it's a ministerial function, that these people were negligent. Purdy and Brown Eyes are similar to other involved statutes, similar to other statutes that have a good faith component. That's not what these statutes did. These statutes didn't provide a good faith defense. They didn't propose a heightened burden of proof or some such thing as was authorized in Vilhauer and the other statutes. Here, the way they interpret and want this court to apply these statutes, they absolutely bar any claim involving a prison where a civilian, we're not talking about prison litigation, we're talking about a citizen, a private citizen, whether it's a lawyer that's up there visiting his client, a teacher, a minister, a visitor, a judge, anybody. Anything that happens to you up there is fair game under their interpretation of this statute. And it's not only that. Mr. Moore even argued that it reaches beyond the walls of the prison. My partner reminded me when we were coming up here for this argument that he just yesterday saw prison officials delivering an inmate to some facility, I assume, for medical care. Okay, he drove him there. So he runs into somebody and injures him. Well, providing transportation to inmates, I assume, is a service under this statute, and it doesn't matter if you run into anybody and hurt them. There's no claim. They're asking this court to essentially overrule Kylo. You know, their argument is basically, they say security's job one. They say the reason we need this broad immunity is for efficient operation of the prison. We're not asking. The question that comes to my mind is, how is it efficient operation of the prison to allow for the employees to not even follow their own rules and allow people to commit vicious crimes and assaults up there? That doesn't serve any purpose. It doesn't serve any legitimate state interest in the efficient operation of a prison. And then they suggest, oh, by the way, we said in Hancock that you can go into federal court and bring a federal civil rights claim. Well, guess what? We looked at that. There isn't. A civilian in a prison setting has less rights than an inmate under our federal constitution. An inmate is protected by the Eighth Amendment provision against cruel and unusual punishment, and the standard is determined to be reckless disregard or deliberate indifference. Under the federal constitution, the Supreme Court, basically in the DeShaney case, says there is no federal constitutional right to protect somebody against the violent acts of someone else. So we don't have a constitutional claim that we can bring into court. And what they're arguing for is basically a tort-free zone up there. They basically, and it's not just there. It's any place that their employees or inmates are out and about in connection with operations or services connected with the facility, whether it's transporting them between facilities, whether it's transporting them for medical treatment, whatever. The citizens of South Dakota are not protected, even though they say security is job one. We submit that the concession that we heard today, that this was a ministerial function, that they were negligent, and that they conceded that, means under Kylo that the masses are entitled to a remedy. That the court and the legislature can't abolish or abrogate a claim. And that's all we're saying is, at common law, a claim existed for a state employee who negligently performed a ministerial function. Well, they've just conceded that. We believe that we have a claim. Under the,
if we rule in your favor on Section 8, what claims would remain immunized? What types of negligent claims would still be immunized? The statute has to provide some immunity.
I think that the statute would provide immunity for, as it says, failure to, okay, they double cell in, we don't have sufficient equipment or facilities. We're double and triple selling inmates because we just don't have the space. I think that that's protected. I think that we don't provide treatment programs for inmates for alcohol or drug abuse because, for whatever reason, that's protected. Those kinds of services and programs don't have to be provided under here. That's what the type of activities that I think this statute was intended to protect. But it clearly can't give blanket immunity for ministerial functions under Kylo and under the open courts provision. I think that's clear. And with respect to the third party beneficiary claim, Your Honor, Randy worked for CBM. CBM had the contract with the state. CBM is a corporation. Their claim is the only beneficiary of the contract can be CBM. Well, a corporation can only act through its employees, which is what it did here. If it means anything, it means that they should be protected. And even the state employees that we deposed admitted that it was their job to prevent inmates from unauthorized access to the kitchen, and they admitted that it was their job to provide security for that kitchen area. They've admitted that. This is not some great discretionary function either, and it wouldn't have to be because under the third-party beneficiary claim, those distinctions don't apply. But I think that claim is viable as well. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, we respectfully request that the court reverse this case and remand it for a trial on the merits.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes. We will have a rules hearing at 11 o'clock. We anticipate that will be a short proceeding, and then at 11:30 we will have our third and final oral argument.